All right, today I'm here with Davis, an enthusiast backcountry split boarder, who's going to be giving us a little bit of background on how it is to get started with backcountry skiing, because he has an idea and he's actually starting to pick up new clients to be able to go out and do this himself this coming winter. So if that's something you guys are interested in, I suggest sticking through to listen to his story, because he is a wealth of knowledge that I think all of us can learn from. So with no further ado, Davis, how are you doing today, man?
I'm doing well, man. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. So how does somebody get started out with backcountry
boarding? I first started out, so I've been snowboarding from Michigan, which is the hills, since I've been like 8 years old. And I knew I wanted to come out to the big mountains at some point. And in those big mountains, I'd see these videos of these guys just doing absolutely wild things. And I realized they were never on resort. They're always in backcountry. And so as I got older and I moved to Colorado, that was my dream to go. And having 15 plus years of snowboarding experience, I felt pretty acquainted with what the resorts could offer. And I knew that if I go to the backcountry, that's where I can progress my skills and really challenge myself. And so I started to learn the education to actually go out there and be safe about it, because the last thing I want is me not coming back to my car at the end of the day. And so you have to take those safety precautions to get there. So there's a lot into that, and we're going to break that down a little bit more of what those safety precautions are. But yeah, that's a start from there.
Yeah, because it seems like a fear that people have, at least I have had with backcountry, is like, oh, what happens if an avalanche happens?
Yeah.
So like, how do you go about figuring out, okay, this is a safe place for me to go versus this is a place that I probably should stay away from?
Yeah, so there's a lot of tools that I use. A few of them are Caltopo, C-A-L-T-O-P-O, online, and that can give you a transparency layering of maps of the mountains. You can put in different areas you're wanting to explore, and then that'll give you the degrees of each slope that you can go down. And you can track what slope you want to go down if you have something in mind. Let's say we're here in Colorado. A very popular pass is Berthoud Pass, going up to Winter Park. And so you go look at Berthoud Pass, and you can see the different angles that there are on the slopes. Anything 30 to 45 is avalanche territory. 30 degrees to 45 degrees is avalanche territory. You're getting it close with the high 20s, you might get some slough. And slough is you go in to make a turn of any sort, and it kind of just breaks on you and starts falling you down. But it's not technically an avalanche. It hasn't fully broken the snow. But at that 30-degree mark, you can make that turn, and the entire layering of X feet can break on you, and that's when you have some issues. And so yeah, there's tools that you can have that you really should have, which are beacon, shovel, and probe. In this case, if Caleb had a beacon, shovel, and probe, he's doing that for my sake. My beacon, shovel, probe is for his sake, because if something were to come down and you're riding that mountain, we're not riding two at a time. We're riding one by one. And so if something were to come down, I'm in a safe trajectory. You're coming down this mountain, and if something were to break and you're getting caught in that avalanche, that beacon on you is going to transpond you to me. So I turn my beacon on. I flip it to searching. And then I start panning to find where your beacon is. And then I take my shovel out, or I take my probe out, and I start probing, and I basically stab your body. And once I find you, that's when I start digging for life's sake. The scariest part is you have about no more than 15 minutes to find search and rescue. In that 15 minutes, you're more like 9.5 is what the odds are of getting out and good and walking away. But the tools in there to do that, there's a lot in there that you have to check there. So we can talk about that. It's not just going out. I'm not going out to a parking lot, grabbing my stuff and walking up the mountain. That's the last thing I'm doing. So there's a lot of planning involved in that.
Yeah, because it seems like there's, I feel like, a fear, because what happens if, say, you do most of your stuff by yourself?
I do.
So, like,
it's just wild.
With you doing it by yourself, there's got to be some sort, like, you have your own safety procedures
yeah.
in place.
And so I've talked to a lot of people. They think I'm crazy for going on my own. They think it's absolutely wild because I don't have that safety net. I enjoy it because I find that I'm not going to push myself anything more than what I want at that current time. And so if I'm out there with a buddy and we're looking at this really, really nice line, but it's a little avalanche sketchy, there's different breaks we've seen, the terrain we've gone across has been some cracking, we've seen some avalanche precautions, and he's like, I think we should do it. Then I'm going to also think, all right, let's do it, right? But knowing that I'm solo, that safety net is, I can't do that. Like, it is not the snow, it's not the conditions for it, it's absolute no-go, and I just turn away. And so me going solo is more of a safety precaution than actually me going with a big group, because I feel like I would try different things that could potentially end in a not so fun way.
Yeah, you're almost limiting yourself, where you're like, you're not being peer pressured.
Yeah, there's no peer pressure. I learned that actually from another enthusiast. He's probably done this for 15 to 20 years, and he only's gone solo for like 12 years. And it's because he's gone with big groups and he's gotten pressured into doing things he didn't feel comfortable with. And so now he consistently goes solo. And he's like, if I want to do it, great. If I want to go again, great. Nobody's going to tell me no. And you have to wake up early. I've tried not to go all solo all the time. I don't go solo all the time. But sometimes people just kind of don't wake up. And you're out there alone. And it's like, I know the safety precautions it take to do that, where I get to go home and have lunch.
Yeah, it's like you want to do something so badly, regardless of what other people are doing, you're going to still be out there 4 a.m., 3 a.m., yeah, like sleeping in your car the night before to make, yeah, sure that you get that fresh pow to be able to shred down. And like, I've seen videos of you doing it too. Like the GoPros, dude, it's absolutely gorgeous. It's just like, if say something was to happen, how would you get out of that situation if you are on your own?
You don't put yourself in the situation. So as I mentioned, the 30 to 45 degree slopes, if I'm solo, I'm not even touching those. I'm not going anywhere near them. Even to the fact, if we're hiking through the backcountry and on the Caltopo maps, you'll be able to see where it gets a little more intense as far as what you're going through, but you are making sure that you are out of avalanche path if anything were to break naturally. So if we're going, there's a case at Bertha Pass, you can go up the main pass and you come to, I believe it's Mount Russell. And Mount Russell is about 12,400 foot elevation at the top. And all around it is over 30 degrees. I think it gets up to 43 degrees for one shoot. And those are your spring shoots. Like you want to hit those in April, even June, if it's possible. Because that's when the snow is at the most consistent time and you can get there. But prior to that, and that is only with a partner, why even think of hiking up there to look at it? Not even go down it. More often than not, I've turned around when I've gotten to the top and I know I can't do that. And let's take the safe precaution route down.
Yeah, which is probably the smart thing. Like, you can look, and there's probably a sense of intuition when you're out there. Like,
yeah,
okay, I feel good about this versus I don't feel good about that. And then you also had, you were telling me something too before we started, was like there's shovels to be able to determine whether or not it is avalanche prone versus not avalanche prone.
Yeah, so there's five different kinds of avalanches. Now I'm putting on the spot.
Hey. It's all good. That's what we're here for. If you don't have something, then...
There's a wet slide. I remember that. There's... the actual term of it? It's going to bother me. I know it's in this little book here. All right, here we go. We got a persistent slab avalanche, a deep slab avalanche, glide avalanche. We have wet slab, wind slab, storm slab, and dry loose avalanche. And all those means different, and cornice. All those mean different things. So wet loose is, it's gonna be facing the south side, it's gonna be facing the sun. So when you have the snow, the new snow falls, and it's really hot that day, and it doesn't really cement to the underlayer, it creates that ice form on the bottom of it. And the snow or skis in this case, if we're to make a turn on that and there's that ice layer, maybe a foot, 2 feet, 3 feet underneath, it only takes, 100 pounds of pressure we think is a lot, but when you're snowboarding, that's one edge turn and that entire cornice can break from under you. And that can cause big to small to, in different avalanches. But you take those precautions of knowing per month, per week, per day, I look at the avalanche report as we already gotten snow. They got about 20 inches of snow up there already, and I've started looking at the avalanche report because if it gets too warm, that's going to create that ice layer on the very bottom of the base for the rest of the season. And so you want it to stay cold or at least melt all the way so you can start that fresh layer and get it all clean. That way that fresh layer that's on the snow just piles on top. Because if we have a bad base layer, which we did in 2021, the entire season was screwed. And there was unfortunately the most deaths in backcountry that they've had since the 80s. And in Colorado specifically and around the country. But yeah, there's a lot of precautions with it. The precautions I take are constantly planning. So I have my book here, and it's just a backcountry decision-making guide. And every day when I go out there, this is dated back in March 6th of 21. So my group check-in, which is just me, ironically, but it was we were looking for slope angles under 30 degrees. So I knew I wasn't going to go to anything more than 30 degrees. The hike I was looking to get, where were we? We were at Loveland Pass this day. And I knew it was going to be about a 2 to 3 hour hike in to where I wanted to go. Didn't really have an idea if there was going to be broken trail, if I was going to be breaking trail, if it was just going to be untouched tracks, whatever it was. The current forecast, we had a north to southeast facing persistent slab. We had a west to southeast facing loose wet possible slab. And then the temperature was 30 to 35 degrees, wind at 15 to 25 mile an hour westerly, which means that cornice that you're going to be looking at the top, if that's a westerly facing, you know that's going to be wind packed, which is going to be very, we call it faceted snow, which is basically like a snowball, just in a very snowflake sense. And so you get so many snowballs on the snow, it's going to roll. And so you get a fresh layer of, we'll call it 5, 6, 10 inches on top with the snowballs at the bottom. It's just like marbles on a floor. You're just going to slide right out. And so that's what we were kind of dealing with. Knowing all of those, I knew that the problems were the persistent slab and the loose wet slab. The elevation for both of those for the persistent slab was about tree line to above, and then the loose wet slab was all around because we did have those sunny days. So at the end of the day, that melting snow is on the top layer, creating some ice with some fresh snow on top of it, creates another ice rink that is possible for snow to slide. So I told myself, I'm avoiding slopes more than 30 degrees on all aspects. We're just gonna cut out all the risk. And so I also have an inclometer with me that I carry at all times. You can also use a phone app, but I'm old school, so I actually have an actual inclometer. And you can leave this and you can have a little fun with that. And it tells you exactly where the 30 to 45 degree slope is. And so when I'm at the top or the bottom and I'm looking up at the slope, I try to line it up with about the angle I believe that that slope is. And then from there, I can know if I'm safe or not to continue.
So it's essentially like what was it called again?
Inclometer.
Inclometer. An inclometer, there's like numbers on it and there's like a little ball inside, and I'm assuming that when you hold it up, it's kind of like you just angle it at some specific angle to be able to get this.
If there was a hill near us, which there's not, of course, but let's just say there was, we're holding it up and I'm gonna aim it up kind of like a sight, and I'm gonna look up towards the top. I'm gonna hold it there and I'm gonna look and be like, oh, that's about 30-32 degrees, that's a no-go. So I look at the next one a little bit over, maybe that's 200 yards over, whatever it may be. I go down, I get that slope. I'm like, oh, that's 22 degrees. Let's go for it.
Okay, so it's almost like you're looking through a scope of a gun of some sort to be able to identify, is
you
this
try to
slope
match it
good?
Up, and they have it on your phone, too, where you can just take a picture of it, and it'll tell you the inclometer. I don't always like to carry my phone, but I like my phone to be on airplane mode. I just want to be away in nature. So I go with the old school actual compass and inclometer.
I feel like that's the best part about getting out into nature, is like you get to have that peace and quiet. Like there's no noise. It's just you versus the mountain.
It's so peaceful. And it's also a little scary because one time I was switching over from, I just came down a run, and I'm jumping around here, apologize. Hey, but I came down a run and I was switching over from riding, going back up. And I swore there were eyes on me. I'm looking around. I'm in the middle of this valley. I'm like, where is this thing? I feel like there's a thing watching me. And I couldn't tell. And this was about late April. And I knew bears were starting to come out of their hibernation. And I was like, I'm still convinced there was something watching me to this day. But other than that one point where I was kind of freaking out, but it's so serene. You get up to the top of that mountain, and you got there by your own free will and power, which just is accomplishment in its own. The dopamine feels so great. You get a snack, maybe you have a beer up there, whatever it may be. You take your 20 minutes, you relax, you get all the sweat off you, and then you get to have the most fun 2 minutes going down. But it's always worth it. It's always worth it. But back on, like, my plan for that day. So this was at Loveland Pass. I told my friends and my family that I was going to be back at the trailhead by 2 p.m. They knew I was going up there, so they had a time. If I'm not back by that time, something's got to happen. And I knew I was planning on being back at about 12:30. So that was a wild break. If anything were to break on me, anything were to happen, I had extra time to know I could get back there and tell them that I'm safe. And then maybe need to go back in to get gear, whatever the case may be. And I had that that extra space there to get there. But knowing where you are at all times. And so I'm following the GPS on my phone for that map that I've already downloaded to know exactly where I can walk, what's not in avalanche territory. And then I had three routes I wanted to try that day. So I had Mount Trelease, which was above treeline. We had a near treeline route on the southwest side of Mount Trelease. And then we had the below treeline, depending on what the snow was. As I went up it, I was going to just call it right then and there. And so as I started going up Mount Trelease, it's a bit spooky because I knew about 2 weeks ago there was actually, unfortunately, a persistent slab avalanche that took a life of a coworker I knew, actually. But supposedly the storm was better this time. And so I wanted to go up and, in a way, also pay respects, but see it. I've been looking at it for so long. And so I went up there, and I went to below treeline. I did not get anywhere near treeline because the snow started getting a little too dicey for me. And it was a great run in thick trees off Loveland Pass. This was on the, what is it? It is the north side of Eisenhower Tunnel of Loveland Pass, not on the A-Basin side. It kind of like back from where you don't normally go. And it was like two and a half feet of fresh, untouched snow. And I was just surfing through. It was so much fun.
Oh, it was, dude, so much fun. Like, that's a dream right there. Fresh on, because I, like, when I go boarding up on the mountains, I get a fresh powder. It's not even fresh powder, but like the fresh powder that you have is like,
it's so different.
Yeah.
So as I observed here, and I wrote down in this little journal, was layers about 18 to 24 inches under between wet snow from sun and dry from cooler temps and shade. And so I knew where the sun hit was wet and corn-like, and then in shade, the snow was dry and fluffy. Good decision. And I really, truly wrote in here, review today's decision and improve today's plan. Good decision, stay below tree line and no greater than 30 degrees. I knew exactly what I wanted to set out to do, and I stayed right on top of it. And that's how I keep myself safe in the backcountry, whether I'm solo or with somebody else.
And you don't have any sort of tracking, like, because I know there's Garmin's or something like that they can, like, do the tracking. You don't have one of those when you go out there?
No. So the app Caltopo and Avenza, I think it's actually the app Avenza on my phone. You can download the Caltopo app that has all the degrees to it. You can put that into Avenza. Avenza then gives you a GPS tracker of where you want, and I can draw my route that I want from home computer to stay out of avalanche terrain. And so I draw that, and I try to follow that pretty closely when I'm going up there. You can't stay on it exactly because trees coming down, rivers that you can't see, you know, just random things. But if I stay on that within 200 feet, I'm pretty comfortable with the safety.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause you're doing probably how many hours of prep before you actually go for a run then?
The first couple times I ever went out 3-4 years ago, I would do a solid hour and a half to 2 hours of prep before I even get the gear together.
Yeah.
Now knowing some zones, I look at the gear, I look at the forecast a week before. If I'm kind of thinking I want to go next week, I'll look at it right now, see what it is, see if there's any new snow forecasted, And then once I get there, I know exactly where I'm going. I have my zones that I like now that I've done so many times. I kind of know them like the back of my hand. And so I don't have any issue going up there as long as I know what it is, and just going. So it's 10, 15 minutes now. But if we were to go to a new zone, there's a couple of zones that I want to try out. I would be full force into 3-4 hours because I'd want to plan the entire day or 2 days, whatever we have planned for XYZ runs, and knowing that we had a plan A, plan B, and plan C for each run that we wanted.
Yeah, and I like, too, how you talked about how it's like 3-4 hours for you to get up to the top.
Yeah, like it's a hike, dude.
two to maybe 10 minutes down or something like that?
Not even.
Not even.
A full run, we're talking, well, I can't say a full run. Once I start hiking up there, the 3 hours is to the very top. And there's no way in hell you're going to get me to go down all the way back to my truck for one run. So you're going to go top to mid, top to mid, top to mid, maybe not all the way to the top again, maybe halfway to the top between that midpoint, like 3/4, and then maybe all the way down, depending on how you're feeling. So in a full day of backcountry, I'm only getting 5,000 to 7,000 vertical feet versus I know at a day at A-Basin or Copper that I'll be pushing 15,000 to 20,000 vertical in a day. But that's also flying on a couch. I mean, you're taking a couch up the mountain versus 2 feet up the mountain. So, big difference.
It's a massive difference. All right, so flying couches, I don't know what that term means.
Flying couches are chairlifts.
Okay.
You get some wild things. You go to Breckenridge, they have 8-person chairlift that weighs 700 pounds. I mean, come on. Like, it's a flying couch. Like, I can lay down on that thing as I'm 40 feet up in the air traveling, you know, 2,000 vertical feet. It's a couch. So I just like to refer to it as a flying couch. I stole that term from a snowboarder reviewer I watch. His name's Avery Snowboarder. Check him out if you want any, like, snowboard inquiries. He does hundreds and hundreds of reviews per year on snowboards, bindings, gear, things like that. But he has the term flying couches, and I definitely love that term. So I use that pretty often.
Well, it's true because, like, I wouldn't say lazy in a sense because you're still out there and you're still working. It's
you're doing more than others.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're just not working as hard as, like, the backcountry enthusiasts are.
Yeah. I mean, so, like, when I go up in the backcountry, it's a full marathon, really. I mean, I know I'm going up with an extra 30 or 40 pounds of gear. On top of that, you're breaking trail or going through at least 6 inches of snow. You're going uphill about 2,000 vertical feet per run, and I like to do 3 to 5 runs per day. Anywhere in there, I'm sweating like crazy. Yeah, I bring different layers. So my first layer going up is just basically my base layer plus a tiny little hoodie or athletic pullover with thin gloves. By the time I get up there, I'm ripping the hoodie off. I put my shell on to just keep in the warmth, but hopefully I can dry out a little bit, and then just kind of dry out, eat a sandwich, make sure you have tons of water. Granola is a big thing. Peanut butter and jelly is always the go-to. And take your time and come back down. And then you're cold by the time you get down, so you just do it again. But, yeah, the flying couches, I really love that term. Just because, I mean, it's so true. You're just sitting on there. You're dangling your feet just like a toddler. You're listening to music most of the time. You're just having a smile on your face looking at the views, and you're just on a couch. I mean, it's pretty nice.
It's a different type. I feel like it takes a different type of person to do what you do. Like, to be able to go out into the backcountry and be out there compared to be the type of person that's on the floating couch, the flying couch. Like, there's something that I feel like you must have internally that compelled you to want to go do the backcountry. Because I know at the beginning you said you were looking for a challenge. Was that all, or is there something else?
I didn't realize until I moved out to Colorado years back, but I think I'm an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah.
And my parents brought this up. They're like, you love to do mountain biking, going down a mountain at 35, 40 miles an hour in a full, like, I'll go up to Mount Trestle in a full face helmet and go do that. And then I like to go out in the backcountry, not even solo necessarily, but most of the time I'm solo. And not play with fate, I would say, because I take those precautions, but there's definitely risks out there. And I just love it. And the challenge that I like to go through is pushing myself. So the snow is not going to be consistent. I mean, I can go on a sun-facing slope, southeast, southwest side, and that snow is going to be a different world than if I go to the north side where it's just shaded and it's colder. It's going to be a completely different style of snow. And going through those in one run, mind you, in unknown obstacles. I mean, you have trees on the ground that you got to jump over sometimes. You have branches that you got to push your way through. You have a branch that you might not even see through your goggles and it hits you in the head. It's happened. And then you got little sharks, which are rocks that come up like a fin. Like, so a shark fin comes out of the water. You have sharks in the snow that are rocks that come out of the water, or in this case, snow, that'll trip you up. And so you have those unknown obstacles that keep you on your toes, whether it's a 2-minute run, a 30-second run, or a 10-minute run. And those challenges I find just exhilarating. It's just, I can't say enough about it. I just have a smile on my face. It's just so much fun. I can't wait to go back.
There's nothing compares to it. Like, you can look at it, you can watch the videos, you can research it all you want. Until you fully experience it, there's nothing compared to it. And then it almost sounds like once you do it once, it's like, okay, I want to do it again.
Oh, I was hooked.
I want to do it again.
I was hooked before I even did the avalanche course. And so I suggest everybody that goes in the backcountry, if you're not taking an avalanche course, you are putting yourself at risk. Or at least going with somebody that has a course certificate. I have a course certificate. I want to get the level 2, and I want to eventually get the level 3, which is the rescue, where I could be part of a rescue team if called upon. But at least the level 1 for intermediate beginner things. The level 2 is, I mean, they all have a cost to them. But the level 1 gets you, I think mine at least was a 3-day course in Rocky Mountain National Park. And there's a couple of different schools that will do it. It was 1 day in classroom and 2 days on mountain. And so in the classroom, you go over the different types of avalanches, what you're looking for in kilometer, how to set it up. You're doing everything we're doing right now. It's like, all right, we want to go out there. We're looking for Loveland Pass, Bertha Pass, whatever it may be. We want XYZ, ABC plans. What are our goals for the day? What are our observations? Everything like that goes through in 1 day, of course. And then you put it to test on the next 2 days. And so we went to 2 different zones. And we had 2 different, wildly different snow experiences. But we dug a pit out there, which we will do in the future once we get enough snow to dig a pit. And you can see the real layers. And that's what it's going to get really interesting with the video, is you'll see the layers of it breaking. And it's kind of terrifying, but super cool. Because 2 feet of snow will just break with like 2 taps of your hand. And it'll just break right off. And that's exactly how an avalanche is caused. But to get the education to go through that is something highly, highly, highly suggest. And Caleb wanted to go up and do it. And I told him we need to step back a little bit. We need some education first, because he was a little overwhelmed with the education I was giving. And, well, you should be. If you're overwhelmed, you're not prepared enough, is really what it comes down to.
Yeah, that was how I felt. When he was telling me, hey, we can go out here, we can do this, we can do that, I was like, let's just sit down. Like, let me have a conversation, Figure this out. Because, like, I'd like to do it. I've been snowboarding for, what, 5-6 years now, I feel like, at this point? No, I've been boarding since I was a kid. But I've never gone backcountry. Like, it's always been on a slope. It's always been a secure place where there's, like, it's taken care of. It's groomed runs, more or less. I've always loved the trees, which is the fun part. So, like, going backcountry and seeing the videos that you do is something that I'm like, all right, this would be pretty sick to give it a try.
I want to pull up the percentage of people that go in backcountry versus resorts. I think, and I want to pull it up before I even say a number, I think it's, like, less than 2% or just at 2%. Mm-hmm. I can't do that right now. But I want to find that number, because most people don't even want it. One, they might just not have the excitement. They might be completely content in the resort. Two, a lot of people are a little lazy. I mean, I'm sweating my ass off up there. And I have my watch, which I don't necessarily trust Apple Watch, but it says I'm burning like 3,000 calories in a day.
Yeah.
and I can go home and eat whatever the heck I want. It's great. But most people don't want to, one, get the gear. The initial cost up front is definitely something that held me back for a couple years. I have a story for that one too. But that initial cost up front is for your lifetime. And that's what I broke it down to. Mm.
So if you're going to be using this for 10 years, like, this is how much money I'm actually spending.
Yeah. And so I was looking at, and I was saving money for doing a helicopter trip. I wanted to go to Silverton, Colorado, and there's Silverton Mountain, which is mostly known for its expansive backcountry terrain. And they have one chairlift. It's a two-person chairlift built back in the 60s. And it hasn't changed since the 60s. There is a tiny little hut that they have there, and you have to be guided at all times from December to, I think it's April. And then in May, they have unguided session. But you have to be guided. You have to have a carry with you at all times, a beacon shovel probe. They have rental stuff for you. But it is backcountry as you can get while not having the necessary education to go in the backcountry yourself. But it'd be a great step in. And they do helicopter drops on some of their terrain that they have up there. And so I was planning on saving this money and going do that for one day. One day, six runs. It's roughly $1,500 to $2,000 for that one day. And I was looking at everything else, and I was like, all right, I got to rent a beacon shovel probe from them. I got to rent a backpack. I got to rent, you have to buy the guide, kind of. It comes with the pass, so that was an extra cost. You got to get the helicopter. I mean, everything was there. And I was looking, okay, well, if I just buy the beacon shovel probe, that's a quarter of my cost. Well, if I buy the snowboard and the skins, that's half my cost. And I can do that for how many years? I think I'm going to do that. And so I pulled the trigger and I did it. And then I got the I bought all that stuff, and then I got the class to get the education for it. But you had to have all this stuff to do the class. And so once I got that, I got that in February of 21, 2020-21 season. In February, and I went out constantly. I think I did only five more days at the resort for the rest of the year, and I did 52 days that year of full snowboarding. And I think only after that, I think I already had 25 to 30 in a resort before then, but I just continually went to the backcountry for the next 3-4 months into June. Because you can ride in the backcountry until June. I mean, you can ride right now. We go up to St. Mary's Glacier, and there's still snow.
Huh.
You can ride 12 months of the year doing backcountry.
That's crazy. So, like, the people that actually do love boarding, like, they can go anytime that they want
to. Yeah, and so there's a couple of Facebook groups out there, and there's, you know, bragging rights. This is my 48th consecutive month on snow. This is my 50-something consecutive months on snow, because they'll go up in August to wherever they can, and whether it's a 100-foot run or a 1,000-foot run, they're on snow for that month of the year. And so it counts, I guess. It's just one of those bragging rights. I guess that's one way to never lose your skill of the year if you don't have the year end.
That is true. Yeah, because too often, like, snow season, I think, comes to an end for the slopes in March most of the time in Colorado.
Most places close in March. A-Basin, you'll get lucky into maybe into May. They love to stay open through June. I think my last day this year was at A-Basin on June 6th. I think it was their closing weekend, but if they can stay through the 4th of July, they try, but it hasn't happened in numerous years.
And I guess, too, if we think about it, like, a season pass at Epic or Icon is around $1,000, I feel like, nowadays.
They've gone up, but yeah.
So, like, and the price to get into backcountry skiing is, I don't even, it's got to be somewhat close, I would assume.
I mean, you can shop around. So Facebook Marketplace is a great spot to find some used gear. Just know what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So I always like to go, if I was buying new, what would I get? And then on Facebook Marketplace, what's available? And just kind of waiting for it. You can, brand new snowboards and split boarding can be anywhere from $1,500 to $600, depending on what you're looking for, what brand you want, XYZ things. That's just a snowboard. Then you have to get the skins, which are like, I should have brought them, but they're basically carpet on the bottom of your split border skis that allow you to go up the hill without sliding back down. And so those are per that one ski. I mean, you cut them to your board. So they don't go on anything else. That's a one board. If you have a different board, you have to get different skins for that board. Or different skis, you have to get different skis for that. Or different skins for that ski. Ooh, that's a tongue twister.
That is a tongue twister.
And then you have to get some bindings. That there's different styles of bindings. Some are backcountry specific. The ones that I have, I can ride on my solid board as well as my split boards. So they have a dual purpose. So I save a little bit of money there, in my head at least, knowing that I can ride those on different boards, not just one board. And then the Beacon Shovel Probe, that's just a cost. I mean, you want to, I personally say you want to get what technology has available. There are some recalls on things that you have to look at before doing that. That can be anywhere from $350 to $500. We're talking new prices, not used, of course, but anywhere from $300 to $500, depending on what you get. You need a backpack to hold it all. Choose your backpack. I got a specific backpack that has an exact zip for my shovel and my probe, and then it has a goggle zip. The beacon is always on you, on your body, and that makes it really helpful. So in that situation, seconds are life and death if that were to happen. And so knowing I have one zipper that I go to and it has everything I need for rescue, I'm content with that. I don't have to dig through anything. I don't have to dump out my backpack. Seconds are exactly what matters in that instance, and it's just ripping you through. Same with the gloves. The weirdest thing is I had to get new gloves for going in the backcountry. Why? It's because I couldn't pull the dang zipper with the gloves I had. Because the finger wouldn't go through, and so I was grabbing at it, and so I realized I need to get new gloves. And it's just one of those things that I felt comfortable. I'd feel more comfortable if I had this, knowing if the situation was there. I think I spent the $2,000 that I saved for myself, and probably a bit more. Plus the boots. I need new boots now because you're walking miles and miles in ski or snowboard boots. The wear and tear on them versus going to a resort where you're just basically sitting in it, going up the flying chair, flying couch, you know, you're just sitting in it. And then the, I don't know, maybe 30 minutes of a run from top to bottom with some breaks in there is all your boots are going to get, versus we're going to hike 5 miles, we're going to ride them down, we're going to hike another mile and a half back up and do that 3 more times, and then finally go to the car. They get a little bit more wear and tear to them. And so you need new boots after 2-3 seasons. I think I have 120 days in my boots, and they've seen better days.
And when you say hike, too, you don't mean you're actually, like, hiking. Like, when I think hiking, I think 1 foot in front of another. But, like, it's more like you're sliding your feet up on the split board, right?
Yeah. So you have – so the split board's a snowboard, right? And in your mind, cut it straight in half. And so now you have it in half. And then you put bindings with a pin or some system on it. Different binding companies have their own systems that basically lock in the toe and allow for that heel to move up and down. And so when that, you have the carpet, we'll call it the skins, the carpet underneath, that allow you to go. And then what's weird in split boarding is you flip them. So your inner edge is on your exterior, which is really weird at times. And it takes a while to get used to. And so the center edge where you cut that board down in the middle is actually on your outside. It's not on the middle. And the reason for that is because that exterior edge of the snowboard is on your inner foot, which is where it's going to be digging in going uphill. There's a reason for it. The first 2 times I set it up how you think it would look, and it's terrible. Like, you can tell a difference when that edge is not engaged. But that is one of the big things with snowboarding that they're trying to advance, because skis, both edges are engaged most times. And so when you're backcountry for skis, you don't have to worry about that. And so they're trying to advance the inner edge on some snowboards can be serrated, not serrated per se, but they have some, I'm going to steal the GNU and the Mervin edge technology that's in there. That's kind of serrated form, goes back and forth so that it will dig into the snow a little bit better. I know Jones is out there doing some things with that, and some other companies have started to lock on to that. But it's interesting. I haven't found a need for it. because if you just flip the board around, it's fine. Yeah. You know, you don't need to buy a new board for it. But, yeah, so I don't remember where we're going with this. Damn.
Well, it was more of the hiking, like how you hike up. Because when I picture hiking, it was 1 foot in front of another, but it's
yeah.
like the sliding of your feet.
It's like big snowshoes.
Yeah.
So when you're tracking through XXX feet of snow, you got to have some form of, I mean, you'll sink about, in really light, fluffy snow, you sink about 10 inches.
Yeah.
But once you do that once, you're going to go up it two or three more times. By the time you do it that third time, it's pretty packed down, and you're just gliding.
Because you do most of the run, like the same run throughout the day when you're going
most
up.
Of the time. So there's a spot I love at Berthoud Pass, and I'll take pretty much the same ascend up there every time I go. Granted, if there's some wind coming off a different way and I'm not trying to get wind whipped the entire way up, I'll go around. But I'm going to come down on a pretty known area. If I think there's some better snow on a different facing slope but still kind of at that peak and I know where it leads to, I will take that. I know where the rock gardens are now. The first year I did not know where the rock gardens were. And you go through that and you're just scraping your board up and you're like, God, that doesn't sound good. And you're still trying to find the powder, but you just turn and you're like, shh, right in some rocks. It's like, okay, you don't do that run again. But, yeah, going up is 90% of what you do in the backcountry. I mean, you're out there to hike. When I go to the backcountry, I know I'm not going there to really snowboard. I'm going there for kind of a mindset change. I mean, you're out there. I sometimes listen to music, sometimes don't. And you're just... I mean, it's the quietest it's ever been, in at least in Colorado, that I've been to. But it's pretty fun. You know you're going 2 hours for 2 minutes of a run, and you just got to accept it.
Yeah. And I'm thinking that some people would be afraid of that quiet. Like, they'd be afraid of being in their own thoughts for 2 to 3 hours if they don't have music or they don't have service. Do you have any ways that you've overcome that, or is it like, how do you manage that quiet when you're out there?
Managing the quiet has never been an issue for me. I have a pretty active mindset and I like to focus on things, and my focus most of the time going up there, I mean, you're getting over 10,000 feet, you're huffing and puffing. And so my focus is basically just 1 foot in front of the other and get to the tree and make sure I don't slide down, because you'll get some icy spots up there. And if you're not placing your skins and they don't grab a hold, you're sliding backwards a couple feet, which it's only a couple feet, but it's still not fun. And so you're trying to save yourself from not falling. And I know on switchbacks, you'd be like, all right, I'm just getting to that tree. And once you get to that tree, you do turning on switchboards is really weird. You gotta make a really long turn, and you're basically like doing the splits out there, because you can't. The way you have to turn it is getting the 1 foot fully over before you can turn and fully get to the other one, because you can't cross them. And so you focus on that. And then you look up and you're like, all right, that's my next switchback. I got to get there. And I just kind of go through it by little challenges, we could say, each time. But there's definitely points where you take a break. And like, my wallpaper is in the backcountry. You just take a break. And you just look up and you're like, this is why I live here.
Yep.
I mean, really, this is why I do it. And in this picture, this was, I think, a couple days after a snowstorm. But it's just nothing but crystal clean power lines.
Dude, and that's the best part about being out there. It's quiet. It's peaceful. Like, I've been at the same place as you. Like, my mind has never been, like, super active. Like, I just focus on the task in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just keep moving forward. And I pace myself with, say, like, okay, I'm just going to make it to this tree, or I'm just going to make it to this branch. And then once I get there, it's like, all right, let's just go up a little bit further. And I feel like, as you were talking about earlier, how some people are lazy and they aren't able to get out there. It's just like, if you just focus on, like, just getting a little bit and a little bit and a little bit, eventually you'll make it to the top of the mountain.
Yeah, it's not putting into, oh my gosh, I have to go 2,500 feet today to do one run for 5 minutes of taking down. It's, I get to just go hike in the winter.
Exactly.
That's it. I'm just going to hike in the winter. The fun part is the fun going down. So, the same year I got my certificate back in 21, I was newer to Colorado and I was hiking 14ers. And for those of anybody that doesn't know, 14er is 14,000 foot mountain. in Colorado. There's 52, 53?
I believe so.
52 or 53. One of those, maybe. And I did a couple that summer into the fall. And I knew of Mount Quandary, just south of Breckenridge, off Hoosier Pass. It's a taller, I think it was 14,000, no, 300-something feet, somewhere in there. And it's one of those that you can snowboard down and ski down, which is awesome. And so there's a couple different routes. And so I woke up one day, and not one day, but I woke up realizing I want to ride down that. How do I do it? Right. And so again, you go look at all your tools that you have in your tool belt to figure out what's the best route up there. That is a pretty hiked 14er. So there is a clear indication of the trail up there. Now in the summer, it's clear trail. In the winter, there's 3, 4, 5 feet of snow on the ground. And so, the day I decided to do this, I think it was a weekday because I wanted less people as possible. And I go up and you're hiking, boots, board, is everything. Everything's on your back because it's starting on dirt. I think it's over 10,000 feet to start, but it's starting on dirt. And you go through a couple miles up and then you get to the point where you're starting to post hole and you're like, all right, it's time to switch over. Put the boots on, put the shoes away, get out the board, get out the skins, get up. And you got 4.5-5 miles of uphill to go. And you got to the top, and one, you just summited a 14er, congratulations, right? Two, you're gonna make it down in 10 minutes. You don't have to watch those suckers walking down for the next 3 hours. You're gonna be in your car in 25 minutes. And so, you know, you enjoy your top ride. You know, you enjoy the top. You look at the scenes, yada, yada, yada. Yeah, congrats, you did it. Now the real fun happens. And there was two choices to go down. There is called Christy Kallur. It's about a 40 to 42 degree slope. And what we know about that already is it is prime avalanche terrain. People have done it that season. I know it. I asked a couple people around at some local shops, and they said, yeah, I think it's safe right now. I'm out there solo again, though, so I choose not to do it, being safe. I also bought an ice axe, in case I wanted to do it, because you're getting at that slope that if you slide, you need something to push into the snow to stop your body from sliding. And so I had that with me just in case. Didn't end up doing that Kallur, just went down basically the easterly trail down that just follows the ridgeline. And it was so fun watching people just be like, that lucky guy just keeps going all the way down. I'm just cruising, doing some nice turns, relaxing the whole way. Every now and then you hit some yoo-hoo, some yoo-hoo. Oh, as you're going down, and I get to the lower part as I can go, and I'm basically right next to the dirt, and I unstrap. I have like a 15-minute hike in my boots to get to my truck, and I have some lunch. You can't do that at a resort.
No.
No.
No, not even close.
It's one of those things. Like, one, you just hiked a 14. You're awesome. Congrats. You're in great shape, I'm sure, if you're doing that, especially in the winter. And two, you have a little bit of bragging rights, which is kind of fun. I told my buddies about it, and they're like, you're crazy. It's like, yeah, well, I've also mountain biked down Pikes Peak, so let's not get too crazy. But that's a different story.
Dude, it just sounds like it's so much fun just getting out there and doing these things.
It's just getting out there, and we live in a pretty lucky spot in Denver. And I think my house is 45 minutes to the Birth of Pass trailhead. It could be less if I wanted it to be. It could be more if it needs to be. But I can make it there pretty dang quick. And once you're there, it's like, well, why not do it, right? You have the ability to. I'm not going to be young forever. I might hurt my hip sometime and not be able to go uphill anymore. So let's do it now. And waking up at the earliest I woke up one day was like 2 o'clock. And I went up to Bertha Pass, and they closed the pass down at 5 a.m. because we had 42 inches of snow. in this parking lot, I was not alone by any means, which, one, surprised me getting up there at, I think it was like 2:45, 3 o'clock in the morning. You had almost every parking spot was filled with a van, a conversion type of some sort. I think I was the second to last person in that parking lot. And I was the only one of two or three that did not sleep there that night. And they knew what was coming. And so by the time I reawoke, once the sun came up a little bit, and it's still, I mean, it came down another 13 inches as I napped for a couple hours. And there was this one guy, he comes out of this hut, and he made a fort in the snow. And he was sleeping there, because snow is an insulator. And so he dug this fort, and it was, you peek in it, and it's like 4 foot tall. It's like 8 foot wide. And he had a little like baby fire, propane fire going in there to warm up his food out of the wind. And he was just having a grand old time. You could see some whiskey over in the side that he was enjoying. Like, he wasn't going anywhere all day long. And so you do a couple runs there and 40 inches of snow.
Oh,
it's coming up to your chest. I mean, you don't think there's ever a limit on, is there too much snow? You're getting pretty close. Let me tell you, over 30 inches, there's almost too much snow. And you can't do the runs I would have loved to do would have been the 30 to 45 degree runs that an avalanche terrain would have on top of 40 inches of fresh snow is just an absolute danger zone. I mean, yeah, you're Top Gun danger zone right there. And so that's a no-go. And so you just have to stay at the low angle, which is slower speeds, which it's coming up to your chest. There's only so much speed you can get to continue on until you're trying to dig yourself out of snow. And they closed down the pass at 5 a.m. I rode until about 11:30, and I could not take it anymore. I was beat. I was fried, already up for X amount of hours of the day. I'm like, all right, it's time to go home. Well, going home took 4 hours. Took 35, 40 minutes to get there. It took 4 hours to go home because lines were shut down, passes were shut down. People that should not have been out in two-wheel drive cars were driving. Would I do it again? Just drop a hat, let's go. Absolutely, no doubt about it.
That's crazy. I wanted to ask you one last thing, and then we'll wrap it up, and you can let people know where they can reach out to you directly if they do want to come out with you and actually go out and experience this firsthand if they're in Colorado or they want to fly out to Colorado. When it comes down to hiking up to the top, if you take off your split board, do you just sink down into the snow? Or is
You post hold.
Okay, so you, like, once you have them on, you just keep them on and you just keep walking.
Yeah, so, like, I mean, you're out there, you got to go to the bathroom sometimes, and you're not taking off your skis, split board, whatever it is. You're just hike over to the trees and kind of you pat down. So like when you're transitioning, you'll pat down the area, just going over it to try to make it as little as possible. So like you'll pick a 10 by 10 area and you just start, you know, doing a little shuffle, patting down the snow. So at least it's somewhat there, and you kind of stomp on a little bit. And then once you take those skins off, you're probably sinking another 6 inches. And then you just throw your skins up top, you know, you don't want to put them on the snow because they slide down. But you do that and then you make your transition.
Oh yeah. So I appreciate you doing this, man. If somebody does want to reach out to you and actually like go out on a tour with you, how, like, what would be the best way for them to contact you?
People can reach me at my email, which is, first initial, last name, D Fryhoff, FryHoff, at iCloud.com. Send me an email and say that you listen to Cable's podcast and you want to go out. Maybe he'll even join us. I know he'll join us at some point.
Yep.
And we can start hitting up there. I normally don't go out until later in the season. As I mentioned, you know the snow conditions at that point. You take the safety precautions. We all take the safety precautions. Unfortunately, if you don't have the gear, I will not be going out with you. Have some education, but I'll be happy to educate as we go along. Have an idea of what you want to ride, kind of what you're thinking of, and we can go from there. I am looking to do a business in the future here that is going to entail that more, but we'll get into that down the road.
That's where we can get this first. You guys can be the first early adopters into this. Everybody starts somewhere, so I figure let's help him out. I think he's, as you guys have been able to tell, very, very knowledgeable about this subject, more than I am, more than probably most of the people listening right now too. So I trust my life in his hands to take me out there, as terrifying as that is, but it's something that, like, I might as well give it a try, because what's the worst that'll happen? We have a great day, or we learn something. So yeah. Appreciate you being on here, man, and sharing your wisdom
with
us.
Thank you for having me, man.
For the past hour, and we'll have to do another episode sometime soon.
Very soon.
Hell yeah, man.